Kay, our speaker tonight, KS, I met her at my home group, the Howe Place, several years ago. I remember there was this effervescent lady that was walking about introducing herself to everybody before the meeting, and so I got to meet her that time, and then several meetings later, same thing happened, which is good because I'm bad at names, and so she's good about coming up and going around, but it was several months after that, I think she pinch hit for somebody else at a speaker meeting that they couldn't make it, and I was quite impressed with her story of recovery, and she also is quite entertaining. So without any further ado, I give you KS.
Wow, hey, my name's Kay. I'm an alcoholic. And a lot of other things, too. I qualify for a lot of things. I'm glad y'all are here. It's good to be out here on a Friday night and not be drunk. You know, that's a miracle in and of itself. John took us to dinner tonight at Maggiano's, Little Italy. Y'all know what that is? I'm from Rockmart. We don't have that kind of stuff. We got Waffle House. I've always thought Ridgeview should put a booth in Waffle House, you know, because there's so many drunks that are in there, sober and otherwise. Go in, get them scattered, covered, smothered, and chunked, and go to detox tonight. If you've never been to Rockmart, it's just out 278 toward Cedartown, toward Alabama. Got a big sign, welcome to Rockmart, where the cars are on blocks and the homes are on wheels. You'll know where we are. But I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And most of us here probably know a lot about what it used to be like, so I'll try not to spend so much time on that. But I was basically born into an alcoholic home. I was born an Al-Anon, and we have any Al-Anons here, they'll be cleaning up, fixing stuff later. I'll be with you. Wiping down the bathroom counter a while ago. It's what we do. It's what we do. I love the story about the difference between an alcoholic, a drug addict, and a codependent. An alcoholic would drive his car into a tree and get out and say, I got to quit driving. Drug addict would drive the car into that same tree and get out and bust out laughing and say, it ain't my car, I stole it. Al-Anon would go out there the next day, cut that tree down, saying, you'll never cause this to happen again. That's what we do. So I was born into an alcoholic home. My daddy was an alcoholic, died an alcoholic death when I was 14 years old. He literally drank an overdose of beer. And I, with a bottle in one hand and handheld to God at 14 years old, 2 months later, took my first drink on my own and said, I'll never turn out to be like my daddy. And I was actually introduced to my first drink at about 8 years old. It was given to me as cough syrup. My mother, I had bronchitis a lot. I was grateful for that. had bronchitis a lot growing up, and they give me cough syrup, but if doctor told her, well, she coughs in between to scare his little sugar with some wheat soaked in whiskey. And, you know, it's like, Daddy, go to the beer store and get the baby some whiskey. She's got a cough. So that was my first introduction. And I understood when I came to the program and they talked about that phenomenon of craving. I knew what they meant because at 8 years old, I hated the way that that whiskey tasted. I would hack and gag and spit and say, please don't give me that again. And then I would fake coughing. I actually remember faking coughing. You've done it, you know. We've all done that. I would fake coughing so that she would, so I know that that's the body taking over the mind in those cases. But Daddy died when I was 14. I started drinking at 14, and I literally drank for 20 years. I had to have some form of anesthesia. I was a victim of a lot of things growing up. I'm not going to really go into that. You can just set your mind and imagine some of the most horrific kinds of child victimization you can go through. And then later I became a volunteer. You know, I say I was a victim as a child, but I became a volunteer as an adult, and I signed up for it myself. Got into abusive relationships, you know, and you know, beat me, hurt me, made me write bad checks. Gosh, I miss him. That's what we do. That's what we do. But he loves me. No. So I got married right out of high school, married my first alcoholic husband. He was violent, you know, blah, blah, blah. Divorced him before I killed him 4 years later. Actually, 6 years later. We stayed together 4 years. I divorced him at the six-year level. And 6 years later, married number two. And I only stayed married to him for 4 months. I think I just wasn't as patient as I was the first go around. I only stayed there 4 months. In fact, I was telling somebody yesterday, it's kind of sad, but the day I was moving out, we didn't really have a reception. We had just a party. We had a party after the wedding, so we had, you know, tortilla chips and whatnot. We bought a case of tortilla chips at Sam's, and the day I was moving out, I had one thing left that I needed a box for, and there those chips were. And I said, oh, dump those out and give me that box. And somebody goes, well, this bag's never been opened. Reckon they're still fresh? Because it's been 4 months. I was like, no, those are from the wedding. They're like, it's been 4 months. So we ate the chips from the reception the day I moved out from that marriage. Oh, that's really sad. But that's what we do. That's the kind of stuff that we do. Somebody asked me one time, why'd you quit drinking? I said, because I got tired of waking up married to people I don't like. Motivation right there. Like that. So I left him after 4 months, and my best friend, who's just my best friend in the world, she got to the program 90 days before I did, and believe me, that competitive edge has kept me sober for the better part of 14 years. So she just, you know, beat me over the head and said, you, there's something wrong with you, you need to go to therapy. And so I did, and built her a new wing on her house, and lied to her for 5 years because I was doing, you know, I was drinking and doing my stuff, you know, while she was trying to help me. And I'd had enough of her, so I decided the geographical cure would fix everything. So I moved to Savannah, Georgia. By this time, it was in the early 90s, and I had always made people laugh at work, and I had been encouraged by a couple of people for me to do stand-up comedy, you know, and I was stupid enough, well, that sounds like a good idea. So I always say I sold everything I owned and quit my day job and took that $200 and put it in the bank and hit the road. So, because we don't really own a lot when we're drinking. Y'all notice that. You can trash a whole house and you're out $12. It's like the power company's bound to come back through. We can get a new coffee table. Schools. Yeah, the big spools of wires. Thank you, darling. You were my roommate at one time, weren't you? No, I'm just kidding. But I did. I started in the stand-up comedy in 1991, quit my day job in 1992, and stayed on the road for the better part of about 7 years, and then got sober in 95, hit a bottom, as we all do. Mine was not really a physical bottom. It was more of a spiritual and emotional bottom. I had gotten into a bad relationship. Oh, what a shock. You know, he was the, I was working at a comedy club in Augusta, and he was the bar back. And, you know, that's a good, you know, good job. It's a good job to get you through college or something, but this was like his career, you know. It's like, the French fry guy dies, he's getting promoted. And I don't want to offend you if you're the French fry guy. It's not that. It's just that he didn't have many ambitions. And, you know, and I kept thinking, I just wish I could meet a nice guy, you know. And it's like, well, are you going to bars to meet him? So this relationship didn't work out. And I hit quite the emotional and spiritual bottom with that. And I came home with my tail tucked between my legs September 8th, 1995. And in fear for my life because he was threatening. He never came right out and said he was going to do anything. He just kept, you know, kind of alluding to that. And then after I got back, he was calling me constantly. And I went to therapy the next day. I thought, well, I better start this over again. I had moved back from Savannah at this point, and I was living back in Atlanta. And I thought, you know, maybe I need to just go back to therapy. And that was the first day I admitted to my therapist that I did something in my waking hours all the time, that I was never really sober, you know, or coherent. And she said, well, you've got a problem that I can't help you with. Well, like I said, my best friend of, at that time, she was my best friend of about 15 years. She had been, I knew she needed to get sober, because, you know, we know. When other people need to get sober. And so she had been in AA for right at 90 days at that point. She'd invited me to come see her pick up her 30-day chip, and I just, you know, looking at my watch, you know, get me out of here. I thought they had Quaalude coffee day because everybody was so happy. I'm just like, you people are crazy. There's no way all these people are sober. You know, of course you think that when you're that miserable. And so now it's right at her 90-day mark, and I'm home, and my tail is tucked between my legs. And that Friday night, Saturday night, she got right in my face and said, I said, well, I've hit rock bottom, and there's nowhere to go from here but up. And she said, no, you haven't hit rock bottom yet, because rock bottom is 6 feet under. And if you keep doing what you're doing with the people that you're doing it with, that's on its way for you, Kay. And I didn't like that one bit. So I left there, and that actually was Friday night. I left there, went to my therapist the next day. She tells me, you got a problem I can't help you with. Kathy's inviting me to come back to the meeting Sunday because I'm getting my 90-day chip, and just pray about it. You know, I was ready to kill her. And it's not somebody you want to be around when, you know, you're that miserable. And I was actually a friend, my cousin was staying with me, and she gave me a book. It was a book about God, seeking God, you know, finding spirituality. And I'm sitting in bed doing what I normally do, you know, getting high, reading about God. And I'm like, you ain't done it. I'd read some of the Bible. I knew why that manna fell from the sky. They were all high in the desert. And I really did. I was at a meeting in Columbia, South Carolina, and the way I worded that was, I said, I was laying in bed, reading about God, getting high, and I realized I'm insane. And you really have to be careful what you say in meetings, because we don't have the best ears. You know, we hear we have a disease of perception. And this little man comes up to me after the meeting. He goes, what book did you read that God smoked bought? I was like, dude, there was a comma there. okay. So I felt like, you know, you're insane. You know, you're trying to get your life straightened out. You want to meet a nice guy, and you're doing all this. So now I've got this invitation to go with her to get her 90-day chip the next day. And I put the book down, set the alarm, and I went that morning. And that was September 10th, 1995. And by the grace of God, that's my sobriety date. And that's And I always say, you know, I only have one white chip, but the only reason I only have one white chip is for 20 years, every time I should have been picking up a white chip, I just picked up another drink instead, you know. And I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I really felt like I was done. At least I was done for that day, you know. And they said, it's just for today. And I was like, yeah, right. She's been sober 90 days. That seemed like an eternity to me. You know, but I had to do something. I was either going to kill her or get sober or get rid of her because she was just happy, you know. And so I got busy, started working the steps, and I was still traveling at this time. My second day in the program, my third meeting, I was at Howe Place, and if you've never been there, it's a wonderful place to go to meetings. Just so happened that day a fight broke out at the meeting. And not something that happens all the time, hadn't happened again in 14 years, but that day a fight broke out at the meeting. I mean, the guy was sitting at the, we had smokers and non-smokers, you know, it was like the non-smoking chair, and then the and it just so happened the guy sitting in the non-smoking chair didn't like what the guy sitting over here was saying, and apparently later I found out he was like taking his inventory and publishing it in the meeting. And so, you know, the next person starts sharing. The next thing we know, you know, chairs are being turned over and he's getting knocked around. And, you know, they go over there and they break it up. Everybody just sits back down. The chair person goes, who'd like to share next? Being so intelligent, I'd like to. And, you know, I went up to this guy after the meeting. If anybody that ever goes there, Charlie, Indian Charlie, been sober 100 years. And I went up, Charlie's just so happy. He just, oh, well, this is just, it's a miracle. I'm a miracle, you're a miracle, everything's a miracle. Charlie's just always so happy. I went up to him after the meeting, and I said, what in the world? I'd seen him at the meeting the day before, and I said, what in the world was that? Well, I don't know, but God wanted you to see it for some reason, so just keep coming back. I'm just stupid enough to go, okay, I'll be back tomorrow. But actually, I had to start traveling again. I was booked in Memphis that next day, and the next 28 days I spent on the road. I didn't come home until I picked up my 30-day chip. So I had to go to meetings on the road. You know, I just didn't want to. My first trip was to Memphis, and I literally got there that night, did a show, and had to get up the next morning and drive to Greenville. When my best friend, and she later became my sponsor, she calls me the next day and she said, well, have you been to a meeting yet? Have you prayed about it? I was like, well, no, I didn't get to go, you know, blah, blah, blah. I said, but I'm so tired. You know, I got to do a show tonight. I got to go work for 15 minutes. I can't fathom going to a meeting for an hour. She said, at that point, I was about 5 days sober, and she said, Kay, 5 days ago, because the meeting was like 5 miles away, and I said, but it's non-smoking, and you know, and she said, 5 days ago, if you could have gotten liquor for $1 and had to go outside and smoke a cigarette, would you have gone? Well, yeah. She said, get your butt out of that bed and go to a meeting. And I did, and of course, you know, a lot of emotion. I remember that night, there were some DJs from the local radio, John Boy and Billy. I don't know if they used to have that show here. They were there, and they start lining up shots on the bar. Let's get K-Dog drunk, you know, and I'm like, no, that's been done. Thank you. For 20 years, and I'm trying to think, how in the world am I going to get out of here? And this is when I really started seeing God work, is that as a comedian traveling in these hotels, especially the hotels where the club was inside the hotel, Sometimes they treated you like royalty, sometimes they treated you like dirt, and you just never knew. And half the time, we wouldn't get our phone messages even in our room when we'd call the front desk and beg for them. So this is how God started working early on. As I'm standing there, I'm looking at this line of shots. I've got 5 days under my belt. I've been to maybe 4 meetings in 5 days. I've seen a fight. And I'm thinking, God help me, how am I going to get out of this? You know, because I didn't know what to say. I wanted to say, I'm a drunk. And because they had said, so are we, you know. She's blonde. The box said, natural blonde. I this lady tapped me on the shoulder, and I turned around, and it was the front desk clerk, and she handed me a message. A phone message, and she said, this lady has called for you a couple of different times. I think it may be important. And I looked down, and it was my best friend. It was my sponsor. And I said, guys, this is a really important phone call. I got to go take it. And I was able to just excuse myself and get out of there. And, you know, God's hand has been there. You know, I mean, just the things that have happened, not just in early sobriety, but in the years that I've been sober, how he's worked. I remember my second week sober, I was in Columbia, South Carolina, because my career was on the rise. And I was working in entertainment meccas all over the Eastern Seaboard. And I was in Columbia, and I was so excited because now I've been to some meetings on the road, and now it's new city and new AA, and I'm going to go. And I get to the hotel just enough time. I figured there's probably, if I'd looked at the schedule in advance, and there was a 5:30, 6 o'clock meeting. And so I got there just in time, threw my stuff in the hotel room, and called the intergroup office and asked them, where is this meeting? And they just said, go down. And I'd lived in Columbia before. Drunk. I knew where all the bars were. And they said, go down Broad River Road and, you know, just it's there on, or go down Bush River Road and it's there on Broad River or whatever. And so I go and I'm like, they didn't tell me. I said, where do I turn, right or left? I don't know, it's just this address. So I get to the intersection and I'm just freaking out and, you know, because I'm 8 days sober. My head's spinning around. And so I turned left, gotten caught in traffic, and I finally get back over to where the meeting is. If I'd have just slowed down enough and looked, the meeting was right there. I could have seen the billow of smoke come from the... I would have known. So I get there, and now they've already done the readings. They split the meeting. The smokers are outside, and they don't know who I am, and I didn't get to tell them that I was a visitor. And so I get there, and I have to sit on the picnic bench with them, and they're doing the meeting format where they share, and then they call on somebody. Well, they didn't know me, so nobody called on me. And I'm sitting there with my wealth of, you know, 8 days of knowledge wanting to share. So nobody called on me, so I didn't get to share. And after the meeting, I go running up to the chairperson. I go, who's in charge? Are you in charge? You were running the meeting. Are you in charge? And she goes, nobody's really in charge. God's in charge. And I said, well, I just wanted somebody to know that I would have been here on time. But I called your intergroup office, and they need to be able to tell out-of-towners how to get to these meetings. You know, and I just go, oh, that. She's like, you haven't been sober very long, have you? I'm like, 8 days, why do you ask? Coming apart at the seams. I wish I'd have kept my mouth shut at least the first 10 years. I wish I got something to say, you know. Don't we know that? But it's good. You know, I encourage you, if you're ever traveling, please, please, please go to different meetings. Go to meetings out of town. That's one thing I think that God did for me. My first 2 years, even though I was in a kind of a volatile situation because I was working in bars, I really didn't drink. I found out very early on doing stand-up comedy, I could not drink and go on stage because the one night that I did, I blew my closing joke. I mean, it was just like... they were about as quiet as you are right now, and that's not good when you're leaving the stage. So I didn't drink during the show. I'd sometimes hang out at the Atlanta Punchline after the show, but I didn't drink during the show, so that kind of kept me safe. But I just encourage you, if you're out of town, you know, go to different meetings. And even if you're in town, go to different meetings. Because I think part of what God was doing in that was those 2 years early on, it kept me from getting caught up in the personalities. Because, I just want to fix everybody. I did. I'm married to my third alcoholic husband. I thought PBS should give me my own show called This Old Drunk. Be the Bob Vila of alcoholics here. Marry you and fix you up, baby. I met my husband in the program. He's a precious man. We have a precious little girl that's here with us tonight. She's 11. She's never seen her mom or daddy drunk, you know, and that's a miracle. And he's not feeling too good. He couldn't be here with us tonight, but he's one of my biggest fans, and I just love him to pieces. But, you know, we met in the program, and I always say that, you know, I met him sober, and he's been sober ever since. But because he didn't do it right, I went to Al-Anon. And it's not because he didn't do it right, it's because I was thinking he didn't do it right. So that's why I went to Al-Anon. This is not a pretty disease. It's, alcoholics don't die pretty deaths. And we've buried a lot in this program. We buried his brother, my husband's brother. That was part of the driving force that drove me into Al-Anon, was I was trying to fix him. And if screaming at somebody could get them sober, he would be alive and sober today. But I realized after I got into Al-Anon those last 2 years that he was alive, it gave me the tools to be able to love him right where he was instead of where I wanted him to be. Because he was never going to get to where I wanted him to be. I needed to love him where he was, because that's where he was. And, you know, sometimes I think that as alcoholics, we are somewhat intolerant of those around us if they drink again. I don't know if that's just me, but, you know, I saw that in myself. I was very intolerant of him. It's like, oh, you just need to quit. You just need to quit. And it's like, it hit me one day. Nobody ever made me quit by screaming at me and telling me I needed to quit. I needed to love him, you know. I needed to just love him right where he was at. And not love him to death, you know, not lie to him and say, oh, you're doing good, brother, but not judge him and beat him up either. In those last couple of years, he lived in Macon. We were here in Atlanta. I was able to see him, you know, from time to time. And at family functions, you know, he would always go out and have to have a sip of beer. And he would come back. And if I saw him right after he'd been outside, he'd say, oh, you know what I've been doing, sis. And I'm sorry, but that's just where I'm at right now. And I'd just say, I love you. You know, just I love you. And he died an alcoholic death in October of 2002. He was partying with some people, and it was the middle of the night, and they were still up. He was going down to the basement to go to sleep, and he fell down the basement stairs. And they just left him there because he was drunk. He'll sleep it off. And they didn't find him till the next morning, and they kept him alive long enough for his daughter to get here from Alaska to sign the order to take him off life support. So we don't die pretty deaths. We've been through a lot. My husband and I have been through a lot, you know, in our marriage and in sobriety. But there's nothing, absolutely nothing, that a drink would make better. You know, he went through some health problems a couple of years ago. He fell off a ladder. Y'all are thinking, this was funny. What happened? he fell off a ladder, broke his foot, and in the next 11 months ended up having to have 7 surgeries, 3 of which were ICU stays and life-threatening, because the broken foot actually saved his life, because he was a ticking time bomb. He'd already had 2 heart attacks, and we didn't know it, and he had vascular problems. He's diabetic. He was risking amputation, and through all of that, we had no income, and yet we had lights, we had water. Our house note was paid anonymously by a group of people we don't even know to this day who did it. They just sent the house stove for 3 months. Every time we turned around, somebody was putting money in our hands saying, you know, y'all been there for us. We're going to be there for you. And it just, God just was there, you know, to provide for us through all of that. Just absolutely amazing. So tonight, if you're here and you don't have a higher power yet, I'm not one of those that'll tell you to believe in a doorknob, because doorknobs can have loose screws, and I don't need a higher power that's got a loose screw, because some people tell you, you know, a tree can be your higher power. I've seen trees fall. You know, I've seen them fall in the wind. I've seen them fall by lightning. I need a God that is a rock. And I have a God that is a rock. He's not conference approved, but his daddy is. And some of y'all are going to get that Sunday morning. Always happy to talk to you about my God one-on-one, but find a God of your understanding. If anything, if you have to use anything, use the group as the God, group of drunks is what I was told. You know, use the power that's in these rooms. Believe that I believe, and sometimes that's enough. You know, sometimes that's just enough, just to believe. And, you know, it's been, like I said, September 10th of 1995, and I just can't even begin to tell you the miracles that God has worked in our lives. A few years ago, I was working in the public school system. Our little girl was in pre-K and kindergarten at this school. And, you know, we live in a rural area, and there were some things that were going on that I didn't really like, and I really felt like, you know, God was saying pull her out and homeschool her, because, you know, I had her at 37. I'm only 40 now. I don't have that. Forgot some of y'all know how to do math. but I had her at 37, and, you know, I didn't want to miss her life. You know, I'd been told by a couple of doctors I'd never be able to have any kids. And I used to say in meetings that I didn't have any children. Well, none that I know of. Some pretty long blackouts, but not that long. Lasted quite that long, but I didn't want to miss that, and I wanted to just be able to, you know, to have her at home. And, you know, I don't know if you know anything about homeschooling. We don't eat dirt and grow our own soap or anything. We socialize and get out, and I wear makeup and stuff. A friend of mine said one time I was starting to learn how to bake my own bread and grind wheat and all this, and she's like, what are you, a Mennonite? And I was like, no, we got light bulbs, thank you. But we do get her out and socialize. But I just want to tell you, you know, the life that I came from, I mean, I held down a semi-decent productive day job for several years. I went from job to job to job because that's what we do. Somehow, we always managed to have jobs that where booze was a part of it. You know, even in offices, I always worked for companies that had an executive floor, and I was always best friends with the person who had the key to that closet. And but a person that lived the life that I lived should not be living the life that I live today. You know, and that's only through the grace of God. You know, when I look back, if September 9th, 1995, you had said to me, in the next 10 to 15 years, you will get your life straightened out, you'll clean up your mouth, you'll quit cussing, you will have a child, you'll have a husband that doesn't beat you, you'll have a husband that doesn't call you any names, at least not to your face. He's never called me anything other than Kay, baby, or honey. And that's not the life I came from. That was not the life that I led. And that's not the people that you attract when you're in that mode. And so if you'd have told me on September 9th, 1995, that in just this short amount of time, you'll have a husband that loves you, you'll have a husband that adores you, you'll have a beautiful child, you will homeschool her, you will serve in your church, you will be respected in your community, and you will be on the staff at a Christian family drama troupe, I would have thrown back another shot and said, you are crazy. That is impossible. But not with God. With God, all things are possible. And I always, you know, some of y'all probably remember Jimmy E. Jimmy E was a very dear friend of mine. He was part of the reason that I went to my first meeting. I was, Kathy had invited me. I realized when I was 6 months sober, she didn't invite nobody else. She was inviting me to come. She was inviting the other alcoholics. She knew, come see me get my tip, you know. Jimmy E., he used to speak here. He used to be at Revo's a lot. He was the reason I went to that first meeting, the day that I picked up that chip. And no, he was at the second meeting that I went. I went to see her, get her 30-day chip, and she invited me again. And then the third time is when I picked up my white chip. But Jimmy was always very special to me. And one thing that that I always loved that Jimmy used to say, and I'll close with this, is that I may not be the woman that I ought to be. I may not be the woman that I'm going to be. But I thank God and you people in this program, I am not the woman I used to be. Thank y'all. I love you.